Hello and welcome to this week's edition of The Front Page. It's 1 week until Cheltenham. Exactly 1 week today, we'll be standing in front of the most glorious sporting amphitheatre in the world, waiting for the start of the Supreme Novices. But for this week's show, we're going to delve into five of the biggest stories, biggest talking points around the Cheltenham Festival. There's obviously a plethora of preview nights, preview events, including a fantastic one that was on this YouTube channel last night. We're going to try and differentiate it from that by focusing on the biggest talking points, the biggest storylines, the things which are going to be leading on the front page of the Racing Post next week. And I'm delighted to be joined for that by two of our very best. First of all, in the studio, Chris Cook. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. And joining us live from France is Scott Burton. And Scott, you're actually reporting from somewhere different to usual because you've been on the gallops this morning and you can bring us some live news from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in Chantilly at the moment. I've been out with Noel George and Amanda Zeta home this morning watching Ile Francais school. He, needless to say, jumped very, very well. He's just such a slick operator over his fences. James was very, very happy with him. Noel George has had conversations over the last couple of days with both owners. That's Richard Kelvin Hughes and also Nicolas de la Jeunesse here in France, and they are 90% sure that they're going to go to the Ryanair, which I think if you've been following the markets over the last week, 10 days, tended to be the mood music. But the only thing that would change that is if there was a sudden downpour and it got very, very heavy, or alternatively something unforeseen were to happen to John Bourne in the champion chase. But they think that they're going to go 2.5 miles. They're really, really pleased with the build-up they've had with him. It's been a much, much smoother run into this than they had before they went to Kempton at Christmas, when, you remember, he just got chinned by Banbridge in the King George. Obviously, that was off the back 6-7 weeks after having been pulled up at O'Toole. So they've had a completely different prep. They're very, very happy.
Excellent. And I'm
it's all system to go.
I'm going to put you on the spot, Scott. Is it the right decision to go for the Ryanair?
Yeah, I've always thought it was the right race for him, really. I'm generally one of these people who thinks if you've got a horse that you could run in the Gold Cup, you should run him in the Gold Cup, really. But he clearly didn't. He stayed all right in the King George over 3 miles, as I say, off of an interrupted preparation. The difference between staying 3 miles at Kempton and 3 miles to it at Cheltenham is completely different, as Galopin de Champ tends to prove to his adversaries year in, year out. I think 2.5 miles, let him freewheel from the front. We've seen Alaho do it. We've seen Understow do it. It's a race you can get them all on the stretch. I think he's jumping. It'll put them under an enormous amount of pressure. I think they're in the right race.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Scott. Well, that leads us into the first big talking point, which has got to be the fate of the superstars. We have two bona fide racing superstars, megastars even, going for the Cheltenham Festival. Constitution Hill in the Champion Hurdle and Galopin de Champ in the Gold Cup. Let's quickly assess the fate of these particular favourites, Chris. Let's start with Constitution Hill on Tuesday. Now, that race has become very, very tasty because Elliot and the O'Learys have taken the big swing with Brighter Days Ahead, and they've pitched her into Champion Hurdle, for which she's the biggest prize, 2-1 now. Looks like potentially just a scintilla of a chance that Constitution Hill could hit odds against at some point, which would have been unthinkable.
I mean, if that happened, then I'd really be, you know, getting my betting boots on. The first thing to say about, you know, the number of odds-on favourites we've got at the festival next week, that's sort of become part of the landscape of where we are now, hasn't it? It's an unfamiliar sensation still, I think, for people from my age who remember when, if you had won odds-on fav at a single Cheltenham festival, that would be as much as you'd get. But we'll probably have 6 or 7 next week. Mm. I mean, God bless Michael O'Leary and everyone involved in this decision, because I think it makes the Champion Hurdle, doesn't it? I mean, it was in danger of being, you know, a slightly uninspiring race, at least to contemplate if neither of the mares turned up. Now you've not only got a sort of really talented rival, but one who tactically might make it difficult for him. You know, she's probably going to go off in front, isn't she? And then you've got that question about, you know, when do you go and chase? It would be a more worrying situation for them if there was another sort of significant rival in there somewhere that would maybe be held up behind Nico de Bonneville. Mm. And so then you've got the bunny in front and a serious rival behind you, and then you really are sort of in two minds as to sort of when do you push the button. If you worry about this one too much, then suddenly you find that the one in front is uncatchable. I'm the sort of punter who, you know, I'm always trying to get the favourite beaten one way or another. It doesn't always lead me in a good direction. Looking at the market just now, I'm thinking that Brighter Days Ahead really is as sure as she deserves to be, isn't she? Perhaps it's because we've done so much talking about her and her talent.
Well, devil's advocate there is Constitution Hill's price is significantly predicated on his achievements of a couple of years ago.
Absolutely.
And this year,
yes,
he can only beat what's in front of him, as all cliche goes. But on ratings, he has not performed as impressively as Brighter Days Ahead.
I mean, he hasn't had to, but I think if you look at Racing Post ratings, he hasn't run within a stone of his best form in his two runs this year and the only one that we saw him last year. So, yeah, I totally get your point. It's always the risk with these horses that have been around for a while. One day they can't do it anymore, and you probably never find out about it until it happens. But he's only eight, isn't he? So I think, you know, and the trouble that he's had are not the kind of issues that would hold him back now, I think. I don't think they would be undermining at the stage he is now. So, like, a year from now, maybe on age grounds, I'd be thinking, yeah, there must be something to beat him. I don't think we're there yet. 6-4 on the is just now, I think that's, you know, mad as it is to be saying an odds on price is value, I think that's value.
So, Constitution Hill, yay from Chris.
Big yay from me.
Scott, yay or nay, Constitution Hill?
I think tactically it sets up a bit... poses a different question, doesn't it? Because I assume King of Kingsland will be the actual pacemaker. We know that Brighter Days Ahead stays 2.5 miles very strongly. We know that that Lossy Mouse stays that sort of trip as well. So it's a case of how much rope Nico gives them, really. If he's that much better, then it might not matter. But I think he's going to have an interesting 4 minutes, isn't he? Deciding how far to sit off of Brighter Days Ahead, assuming she jumps well. And then everybody seems to have totally forgotten about State Man, but he is the reigning champion. I suspect he'll sit behind Nico. I don't know if Paul Townend will ride him or Lossy Mouth. He seems to be very, very loyal to Lossy Mouth. So I just think it's tactically fascinating. And if she wins, the roof will come off the place. I was really struck by Lee Mottershead's piece with the ITV crew and how much Constitution Hill really, really matters to them, and they feel that matters to their that kind of ITV broad church audience.
Yeah. I
think I was there when he won 2 years ago. I think the reaction will be stellar if he does what we largely expect him to do. But I don't think it's anywhere near as straightforward as it was when it was just State Man and Lossy Mouth, because of the style that they will run the race to try and draw the sting out.
Well, so the other horse that would take the roof off is, of course, Galloping de Champs, going for a third Gold Cup. Now, competition to Galloping looks a fair bit more straightforward than in the Champion Hurdle and Constitution Hill's task. Do you see any dangers at all?
I'm one of these saddos that would love to see Factor File turn up. I mentioned, I think if you've got a Gold Cup horse, you should try it. He's probably not as strong a stayer as Galloping de Champs, but he's got nearly as much talent. And I think if Willie Mullins were be persuaded by JP McManus, Frank Berry and everybody put him in there, I think he makes it interesting. Otherwise, he's by far the best horse in the race. You know, a couple of worthy rivals have fallen by the wayside this year, so he should win. But we should not underestimate what an absolutely phenomenal achievement it would be, even if he wins by a neck or half a length or whatever. Those of us who remember Best Mates, the Gold Cup, when he almost got run down by Robert Allner's redoubtable Serenbramp, who would not have been in anybody's list of top 10 Gold Cup winners had he chinned him. But it's just such a hard thing to keep the wheels on these staying chasers for 3 years. And if he does, it would absolutely be the pinnacle of Willie Mullins' achievements as a trainer. He's got a fair few.
And Chris, you spoke about odds on shots at Cheltenham. 1-2 in the Gold Cup is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, even knowing what a talent this horse is and how Willie is bound to have got him to his peak for this race, you're still not taking that price, are you? Because, you know, even if you discount all the other horses, you still got to get over the fences. And this very horse did fail to do that. Was it 3 years ago? Novice Chaser at the time, admittedly. But, I mean, you've always got to bear in mind there's stuff that can go wrong apart from just the other horses. So, I mean, I wouldn't be taking that whilst being fully respectful of him. I think Willie, it really matters to him to get this horse to win a third Gold Cup. And I don't think he's really at all interested this year in trying to get him beat with one of his other horses. So I'd be surprised if you saw Factophile in that race. And he's already sort of found a different thing to do with Grange Clare West. Banbridge is, you know, if he turns up in the Gold Cup, got to take him very seriously. You wouldn't think the stamina test is going to suit him brilliantly, but the ground is coming right. I think the ground is probably going against Factophile wherever he ends up. So I think realistically we're seeing the third Gold Cup for Galopin, aren't we?
Well, let's hope so, because it would be such a wonderful story, taking aside anything that we lose in terms of not necessarily having a classic, a competitive Gold Cup, to have a three-time winner.
He's a great horse. You've got to celebrate him.
Be amazing. Just before we move on to the next question, any other big favourites that you think are particularly vulnerable?
So I was looking at which trainers have performed with odds on favs over the years. Like the last 10 years, you know, we've had 46 odds on shots at the Cheltenham Festival. It's a huge number. It's amazing.
Over the last
10 years, that is.
Yes, wow.
They've been winning at a rate of 54%, which is barely more than a coin flip. I think, to be honest, we've been getting a bit carried away about some of these horses. Mm-hmm. And so then the rate at which trainers win with those horses is not really so much a reflection on them, it's a reflection on our enthusiasm for the horses that come from that yard. Willie Mullins has had loads. I think his strike rate with odds on shots at Cheltenham is 59%, which is perfectly respectable. Nicky Henderson won 5 times with 6 odds on shots over the last 10 years. So I think that tells you that when we get excited about one of his horses, it's because they deserve to be a short price. I think Constitution Hill, John Bond, both very hard to beat. Tihapu's maybe the one that I'd be interested in taking on. I realise he did this last year. He disappeared from the 1st of December till the festival and still won. Mm. But, you know, given that he ran below his best and got beat last time, you're being asked to take an awful lot on trust at what even money is he now. Nicky Henderson's got a lucky place, you know, sort of up and coming contender about 7-1. I think he's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'd be laying John Bond in the Champion Chase. Been a tough race for Favs in recent years.
Really tough. Yeah. Actually, 6 odds on defeats in the last 9 years. Yeah, I mean, an amazingly bad race for odds on Favs.
Yeah.
But you know, that's not to say that they'll all get beat. I think you'll be all right.
We'll move on to the next big question, and this one is one that exercises racing fans on social media a great deal. And it indeed has been picked up by a lot of the national newspapers in recent days. Where is the best place to watch Cheltenham?
I mean, clearly in the grandstands at Cheltenham. I mean, it's an amazing experience for anyone who hasn't been there. You've just got to make it happen somehow. Lots of my best memories have been in that particular grandstand, you know, in that week. The racing is not maybe quite perfect in the way that it used to be, but it's still an amazing experience.
What is your greatest moment in the grandstand at Cheltenham? What was it?
Maybe the first race after COVID. Also, I was there the first race after Foot and Mouth. You know, we lost 2001 Festival, and the next year we came back in the Supreme. Ended up being a fight between West Ender and Like a Butterfly. And I didn't have a betting involvement. And Adamant and Proach came down at the last hurdle. And the noise that was coming out of the stands when that was going on was really, I think, unlike anything else I've experienced at any other time. And it was actually quite a good race to be a neutral in, because you could just absorb the drama without particularly needing one result or another.
It is amazing. So it's one of the most fantastic, glorious, storied, atmospheric sporting venues in the world, with that stunning natural backdrop of Cleef Hill. However, the zeitgeist is about people saying Cheltenham's too expensive, the experience isn't what it used to be, and you're better watching it at home, or increasingly, I'm not sure how many people actually follow through on this, you're better going to Benidorm or Tenerife or somewhere like that, where it will be on every bar TV, and there'll be apparently a host of like-minded individuals watching the racing in the sunshine, having two Euro beers.
I mean, it's a really interesting creative idea, possibly being pushed because there's some journalists who would, they're trying to persuade their editors that they should be sent out there, right, on an all-expenses-paid trip. Let's find out how big a phenomenon this really is.
We are sending someone to Benidorm for a couple of days. I have to say,
it is
significantly cheaper than sending someone to Cheltenham.
Well, there you go. Cheltenham should be expensive, shouldn't it? Because it's been such a huge event, you know, for like the past 40 years that I've been paying attention anyway. So it fully deserves to be the most expensive week in our sport. And I understand that we all like to sort of moan about it, but, I don't object to a big ticket price. When you get in, they need to be able to provide you with a good experience. And that's where it's, you know, hasn't always met the standard that it should do. You know, you shouldn't have to queue from one race to the next if you're trying to get a drink. You should be able to see the horses. That is much better now that they've got the sort of the new walkway around the top. But the hotels in the town, I'm afraid, I think they're guilty of overcharging.
I actually think, you know, yes, Cheltenham's relatively expensive compared to other big racing events, but compared to big sporting events, it's really good value. We did a piece early in the week, £112 for a club ticket, and there's cheaper tickets available. You know, that compares very favourably. It's less than a Lord's Test match ticket. It's less than Sunday at the Open, it's less than a day on Centre Court at Wimbledon, it's less than a Six Nations match at Twickenham, it's less than a day at Silverstone. It is more than some of the cheapest Premier League tickets, is what you can say for it, but you're probably going to be stood behind pillar or something,
aren't
you?
Absolutely should be.
It's actually good value. The problem is, once you layer on everything else, and the cost of going racing, especially for a multi-day trip, is not primarily in the ticket price. And once you layer on everything else, it becomes quite expensive. And hotel prices in town have been the great sticking point there. We had the Chamber of Commerce saying, hotels aren't being incredibly greedy. They're not pushing the prices up because they can, which I'm not entirely sure what on earth that means.
No.
They clearly are taking a decision to push the tickets up because they can. They know that if they make them £800 a night and they get 90% occupancy, then they're going to do much better than making it £400 a night and getting 100% occupancy.
Sure.
And that's the problem. You know, fundamentally, the hoteliers of Cheltenham have limited supply, there's relatively high demand, and they don't actually mind if that demand comes down a lot, as long as they're still selling most of their rooms at that sky-high rate.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I do notice that the town during festival week is quieter than it used to be, and I suspect that's a big part of it. You know, people are getting more creative, they're looking for other places you can stay. There are quite a few places, you know, around Cheltenham that you can sort of get to the track reasonably quickly. You don't have to be in the town itself. Mm. So I think there's a certain amount of self-harming behaviour, could you call it that? Because, as I say, the town doesn't feel like the same Ballyhoo that I remember in the past. Maybe
and some of my best times at Cheltenham have been in the town afterwards, when the bars are full, everyone's replaying the war stories from the day. That's sometimes the best times of all. The anticipation is high for the following day. The buzz of the action you've just seen is in the air. It's glorious. And without that, you do miss some of the magic,
I think. It can be a bit flat, yeah. I mean, you want that feeling that you can just wander into any pub at all and bump into people who've very obviously just been having the same experience that you've been
and
having.
And seeing people who you might not see from one year to the next, of course, is also one of the joys of Cheltenham.
So, I mean, it's obviously not in the control of racing people to sort of to alter the prices that are, you know, being offered by hotels and to change that experience in the town. But it's a pity something's been lost there. Mm.
Scott, let me bring you in here. You're obviously based in Paris. Do you choose to watch Cheltenham from the comfort of your Parisian abode?
Well, obviously the people who do the news rotor at the Racing Post are much, much kinder and nicer people than anybody would have you believe. And I actually come over and take 2 days holiday and actually come for the first 2 days as a paying customer. I can actually tell you exactly how much a ticket is. So my answer to your original question, where's the best place to watch, is definitely from the club enclosure. Just rather unfortunately, the bar that my friends and I have been frequenting for many, many years happens to be the one next to the press room. So there is always the danger of wandering out onto the walkway there, having had a couple of refreshments and walking into somebody who is working and possibly wishes they were in your position. But it's absolutely the best place to watch it.
And it would be completely unheard of anyone working to pop into that bar as well. We should stress.
No, yeah. I never see anybody.
Never happens.
But just in terms of the ticket price, you have to bear in mind also that this is the Jockey Club's main source of revenue. I read a thing the other day about Turnberry, which, as you know, is the golf course used to be on the open rotor. And is now Trump Turnberry, is owned by the 45th and 47th president of the United States. Obviously, there would be a huge furore if the Open were to go back there. But the RNA has the very, very convenient excuse that they can only get about half as many people to an Open at Turnberry because there's not a railway station and it's there's only one road in and out of the town. And basically, it doesn't make them enough money to do all the other things that they do. And the Jockey Club obviously relies so much on income. That doesn't excuse charging exorbitant prices for a burger or a pint of Guinness or anything. But I do think in terms of ticket price, they offered multiple deals whereby if you bought for more than one day, you got a discount on the second and third days as well. I think they do a pretty good job with that. It's more expensive than it used to be, but then what is it?
Well, I think the consensus here is clear. While watching Cheltenham from anywhere is a pleasure, the best place to be is quite clearly at the racecourse. Let's move on to the next big question. I've actually got two ways of approaching this. The polite way is to say, will Britain fare better than recent greenwashers? The less polite way is to say, will Willie Mullins outscore Britain on his own? What do we think?
And that is about a coin toss, I think. I think last year Willie had nine, Britain had nine. Is that how it was?
Yeah.
I was expecting that Willie would do slightly better because about a week beforehand he had 16 of the favourites or something ridiculous like that. I don't see where our extra winners are coming from. I guess there's been a couple of races that basically been turned into handicaps, which sort of opens things up a little bit. You know, it's the graded races where I think we're really, really vulnerable. Britain, just in case that's not clear. There's no getting away from it. It's going to be an awful lot of Irish success next week. They do make all the best jumps horses. So who's to quarrel with that? That's maybe how it should be.
Do you think Britain will exceed last year's nine?
It's a coin toss. I would expect we're probably going to land on eight, nine again, something like that. So there's Nicky Henderson, obviously, isn't there? That would be the difference from last year. Last year was awful for him.
Yeah. So, if you had Nicky in last year, that nine...
It doesn't work like that, does it? some of the races that might have been won by other Brits last year, maybe he would have won. He's got a couple of odds on shots, and that gives us a pretty good starting point. You know, if you give those two races to Nicky and then say, what can we win beyond that? I'd be fairly amazed if we crack double figures. I'm not seeing where the sort of the general strength of the British jump racing scene has increased since last year.
No. And there's been a lot of conversation recently about British owners taking horses to Ireland or shifting the centre of gravity of their operations over the Irish Sea. If you had a Cheltenham favourite runner with a real chance, who would you want it to be trained by?
I mean, presuming it's got to that stage, I'd just leave it with whoever's turned it into that kind of contender.
Well, let's say you've gone and spent vast sums of money, which is no guarantee of having a Cheltenham Festival running, never mind a Cheltenham Festival favourite. But let's just say you want to...
Spent half a million in France. Yeah. You've got this four-year-old. Where does it go? I still would like to think that this is just fantasy. Of course, I've never owned a racehorse, and it doesn't seem likely. I would be that kind of owner who would support whichever trainer happened to be nearby and you can form a relationship with, you can just sort of pot around the corner and see your horse in the gallops or whatever, that's how it always used to be when I was getting to racing in the 80s. You just take it for granted that, whoever happened to have bought a horse would send it to the train that was 10 miles down the road and they wouldn't get too fussed about what the reputation of that trainer was. It's a new thing, I guess, because people and money are just more portable now than they used to be. And images of your horse on the gallops, for example, could be sent to you like moments after it's happened. And that, I think, has sort of enabled this situation where it doesn't matter where the owner is. You can send his horses wherever. And so, of course, you get more British people who decide to go with Willie or one of the other big-time Irish trainers. I do understand it, but I really regret the situation where more and more of the best horses are ending up in just the one place. And you would like to think at some point one of those big-time owners is going, well, look, this is a bit self-defeating here, you know.
And there's some amazing yards and trainers in Britain as well. But yeah, I'm like you, but perhaps that lack of killer instinct is why precisely why we don't have £500,000 horses.
Maybe that does. Yeah, there are definitely rich people out there going, yes, you put your finger on it there, lads. But I mean, look, jump racing has got to be to some degree about romanticism. You know, that's what made it as popular a sport as it is. And I don't think you can really survive all the stresses and strains of jump racing, you know, and all the bad news and setbacks that come along from time to time without having that kind of romantic streak to you. It can't just be a hard-nosed business. So, you know, support your local trainer.
Indeed. Let's bring in the view from France here. Obviously, with Ile Français, there is a very, very good chance of a French winner, which must be exciting the jumping fraternity over the channel.
Absolutely. I would say there's a bit of a division inside of Noel and Amanda's yard as to whether he's even their best chance. Stencil is favourite for the Fred Winter at the moment. And the I did a piece a couple of weeks ago with a lad called Timothée, who is the work rider who rides both Stencil and Ile Français. And he is adamant that Stencil is the better of the two horses, even though he's not as flashy and as brilliant. He's much more of a kind of a grinding. He's obviously going to be a three-mile chaser in time, but he's very keen on Stencil going forward. David Cottam will be coming with a couple as well. He has Issio Madrick, who went off favourite for one of the cross countries before Christmas and decanted his young jockey at the third. But if he sneaks in at the bottom, he's very, very well handicapped. Fifth in a graded race here a couple of weeks ago, which just about gave him enough extra boost up the handicap to hopefully get him in. And David also runs JetBlue, who won again at Cheltenham before Christmas in a Grade Two, runs in the Albert Barlett, and he'll have James Reevely on board as well. James has got an enviable prop. So I'd be quite disappointed if one of them doesn't pop up. It's a case of trying to light on the right one. It's been a long, long time since there's been as strong a French challenge. And, you know, when you talk, as you say, about people based in Britain who have their horses in Ireland, Noel and Amanda, David Cottam as well, come to that, have plenty of owners from outside of France. Chantilly is pretty close to Charles de Gaulle Airport, but as you say, you get videos sent to you. And if horses are going to end up being run at Cheltenham or Aintree or Punchestown or wherever, then you know, that's where you end up. If I was to, this might sound like I'm currying favour with the other two members of the panel here, but if you were to look at a yard that seems to consistently punch above its weight and seems to have a real eye when it comes to buying horses, not that expensively at the sales and then getting results at both Cheltenham and Ainge, then it's got to be Lucinda Russell and Peter Scudamore. And given that I don't live anywhere near Nicky Henderson or Willie Mullins, and I don't live anywhere near Lucinda, maybe I'd send her all.
Wonderful. Yes, that's the message from this. Have your horses trained in Scotland. Wonderful. Couldn't agree more, and Lucinda does a tremendous job. Let's turn to the changes that they've made for Cheltenham this year, Chris. Most notably, the Turners becoming handicap, cross-country chase also becoming handicap. Also, perhaps obviously in advance, some changes to the race car experience. They've spent a huge amount of money trying to ensure that cars don't sink into the quagmire of the fields used as car parks. And of course, now the forecast looks beautiful and sunny.
Yeah, of course, the law of sod in full effect right there.
Exactly, yeah. What do we think about the changes? Very hard to predict at this point whether after the festival we'll look back and say, the racecourse executive under the new chief executive, Guy Lavender, have got it right. But what's your sense?
I felt that the changes to the race programme were fairly conservative. It counted as tinkering in my eyes. And in terms of trying to make the racing more competitive, I mean, I can see why you would think that you'd done that by providing more handicaps. But as I say, we've ended up in a situation where a week beforehand we got 6 odds on shots. 7 is the record, you know, and if Tihapu goes odds on, then we'll have 7 next week. So there's work to do there. That isn't the sort of thing that you can just turn around in a year, of course. You know, I think there's a real issue about the sort of the number of quality jumps horses available and where they're being trained. And perhaps the Jockey Club feel that they're not best placed to tackle that. So in terms of the racing product, I would think that would be much the same as it is last year. I do slightly regret that the National Hunt Chase has been kicked around so much, changed again, and you can't really say that this is the race that we all remember from 20 years ago or before. It was, it's a race with such a rich history. I think you are really losing something, and I'm not sure that any of that really needed to happen. There's a sort of animus from on high against amateur jockeys at the festival, and I think it's very dangerous and a great shame to have limited them in the way that has happened, because they always contributed a great deal in terms of the excitement and the atmosphere of the festival. You could be sure that those jockeys, it was definitely the peak of the year for them. It really, really mattered just to be involved. So that's a pity. In terms of the race going experience, the stuff with the car park, that absolutely had to happen after last year. Some people were having a wretched time. And when you have paid top dollar, as we've just been describing, for your ticket, you ought to be assured of somewhere to park where you're going to be able to retrieve your car later on in the day. And I would guess that we'll still have problems getting out of those car parks, even if it's good going all round. And if only something could be done to make that a better experience, I think that would really help. So
they're doing a lot of sort of park and ride things as well. They're trying to promote that kind of stuff, aren't they? I don't know how. Then you'll possibly just spend a lot of time waiting on a bus to get out of Cheltenham.
Which, that does happen anyway. We'll see. We hope we cross our fingers and hope for the best. But some of these problems have been lasting for decades. And it's evidently going to take a real genius to solve some of them. To some extent, you just got to suck it up and say, "Well, I'm here at the festival, and I'll deal with one or two bumps in the road if they happen."
Last big question: what story is going under the radar?
I've been sitting here struggling to think about that. I guess it's still below my radar. Do you know the one that occurred to me is a horse rather than a story? Mr. Coffee. He hasn't won a race since 2020. And he's 10 years old now, so that's like half his life ago. But he did win, when I turned up for the gallops at Kempton last week, a gallop against his stable companions, and got a big cheer from Connections. He looked in great shape. He's going for the cross country. Maybe this will be his day. I would quite like it if it did happen. He's quite a charismatic horse, and I don't think there's anything wrong with his attitude. He's just a bit of a plodder, but I like plodders. He led over the second last in the Grand National, I think, a couple of years ago. And to have a horse of that quality that just never wins must be very frustrating. So I quite like to see him win.
The one I thought was Rachel Blackmore. One of the sport's real recognisable stars, very recently had a finest hour, finest days, finest week at Cheltenham. Although perhaps Grand National comes into that as well, but nonetheless,
she exploded
onto the sort of wider sporting consciousness. Obviously, both she and Henry de Bromhead have had a quieter time, but what do we sense? Could they come alive at Cheltenham again?
There's every chance. In fact, someone was just trying to persuade me of that before we came on air. That Henry's back in form, and therefore he's going to have, if it did happen that suddenly his horses are running well, he's going to have a few next week that are below the radar. Of course, it wouldn't surprise you at all if, Rachel pops up in the first. I think that happened last year, didn't it? It really adds to the sort of the atmosphere and the joy of the occasion. So yeah, there's every chance. In fact, I'm going to go away now and see if I can find some of Henry's in the handicaps that might be a bigger price than they should be.
Excellent. There we go. And Scott, from your perspective, any stories going under the radar?
I think one of the things about any huge sporting event, any large music festival or anything really, is that there are only a finite number of things you can actually plan for. And the car parks last year, you can say, right, okay, well, they rushed out a lot of extra sheeting for the subsequent days, covered an enormous amount of space in order to try and clear that up. The one thing you can predict is that something unpredictable will come up. It will be the Wi-Fi coverage, or it will be the toilets overflowing somewhere or whatever. And I think one of the ways you differentiate being at a premium experience, if you like, as opposed to some of the less premium parts of daily life or going on holiday or anything like that, the difference between flying a scheduled airline and a cheap budget airline is having staff around to address the problem really, really quickly, and having management that gets out on the front foot about it. Whatever it is that will turn up next week, it will be on thousands of camera phones straight away. And the watchword for the Cheltenham authorities is to jump on it very, very quickly. As I say, I can't tell you what it's going to be, but something will crop up probably on day one. And whether it be to do with the bars or the betting terminals or blow around the site or whatever it might be, they just need to be ready for the unexpected. I'm sure they will be.
Can I just come back on that? I mean, just to sort of my illustration of how unexpected things happened at Cheltenham. Two or three years ago, I found myself writing a story about Georgia Toffolo, not someone I'd ever really spend much time thinking about from before. She's made in Chelsea, for those who don't know. It so happened that she had a big bet on the forecast in the Supreme Novice Hurdle. I think it might have been when Constitution Hill won. And it came up, didn't it? And, you know, the poor rails bookie, he saw this socialite coming with a big wad of notes in her hand and thought it was his lucky day, you know, found himself about 25 grand behind after one race at the Tingle Cheltenham Festival.
You're having a bad festival. Yeah.
God. So I wrote that story and it ended up being one of the most read of the week. So there you go. I mean, stuff
it's always unexpected.
Happens,
right? I mean, certainly that's from the Racing Post sort of newsroom perspective, it's the unexpected that makes things sing at the festival. That's what get picked up. Big punting victories, shocking turnovers on the track, controversies. These are the things that really get you going, and that is what brilliant first-rate sporting events deliver. They deliver surprises and shocks.
Long winning runs coming to an end, you know, very famous people who would never normally come racing suddenly being there.
Yeah.
You know, there's all sorts of stuff going on.
That's it. We're going to wrap up on Cheltenham there. Just before I do, I'm going to plug two things for you. First of all, I'm going to plug our fantastic Ultimate Guide pullout supplement. It's in all good newsagents now. It's also available in the Racing Post shop. I will send it to you. It's absolutely packed with fantastic insights into the Cheltenham Festival. Order it now. You'll get it in good time before Cheltenham. You should also watch our epic Cheltenham Festival preview show, which was filmed yesterday. David Jennings, Nicky Henderson, Tom Segal, Paul Keeley. Fantastic show, sponsored by Unibet. It's a tremendous piece. You must check it out. I do set aside plenty of time for it. It is longer than most Scorsese films, but worth it, like a Scorsese film. Just before we wrap up, we're very quickly going to turn to the big punting survey. This was our major poll of bettors, which we published results of last week. 10,000 of you responded. Thank you so much to everyone who participated. It's one of the biggest polls of its kind conducted and gives really essential insights into how racing bettors think about the sport, about punting and associated matters. I'm joined by the two reporters who did the hard work crunching the data. First of all, I'll come to you, Scott. What was your key takeaway from the side of the survey that you focused on?
I think probably if you were to pick one number out of all of them, it would be the number of high-staking punters that have admitted to having used the black market. So that's 3 in 10 of people who bet in units, their average bet is £1,000 or more. Now, that may sound like a lot to you and I, but that is, it's not a particularly rare occurrence. And the fact that 3 out of 10 of them have now decided that that is the avenue for them to be able to bet with bookmakers that offer them no customer protection, who pay no tax to the exchequer, and who contribute nothing to the levy, most importantly, was, I thought, a genuinely shocking number. And when you asked across the piece between people who bet £1,000 a race and £1 a race, what reason they give for considering the black market, 68% of them said that it was because of affordability checks. And I just think that that is such a stunning number, say 30%. You have to bear in mind that those big staking punters are responsible for an enormous amount of bookmakers' turnovers and therefore levy generation as well. I think it's something like the top 1% in terms of stakes is well over 50%, up near 70%, I think, probably in terms of gross gambling yield. And if you go to the top 10% by turnover, it's even higher. So that 3 in 10 is just a shocking figure. We had lots and lots of industry reaction, people from the betting industry, but also across the political sector as well, former administrators, current administrators. And I think they were all genuinely hit between the eyes by that number. That's just a sport and a well-regulated industry that is leeching business and income away to a totally, totally regulated part of the sector.
And this will be a major factor at Cheltenham next week. I mean, anyone who speaks to sort of pro punters knows that in those kind of circles, the awareness of the black market and increasingly use of the black market is rife. And increasingly, they don't use, they're not sort of going on and finding dodgy bookmakers operating out of Caribbean islands. They're using encrypted messaging apps, betting through people who are running, you know, relatively reputable businesses, aside from the fact that they're obviously illegal, if that makes sense. So they're not turning to what we might imagine the sort of Wild West. They're actually using small bespoke services, and that will be a major factor at Cheltenham next week for high staking punters. Chris, you looked at the more behavioural side of things. You looked at people's attitudes towards racing, how they think about the sport, how they think about their pastime, how they think about their betting. What was your big takeaway?
Yeah, I'm just going back over it just now. One thing that jumps out at you is more than 71% of people who took part in our survey gave their ages as being 55 or older. I mean, that's in line with what it was the last time. I know that there are executives around the sport who kind of worry about that. You know, the fact that the sport's followership has an older profile, they would like to bring it down. So often when you see marketing initiatives coming from horse racing, it's sort of pitched at people who might be late teenagers in their 20s. And I think it's got to be worth the sport's while pitching at the audience that we actually have and have always had. I mean, it's not a new phenomenon. You know, for the 40 years I've been following the game, most people in the stands have been older. And I think that just reflects the kind of the sport that we are. It's something that people gravitate towards as they get a bit older. You need a bit of money, I think, to follow the sport on a day-to-day basis. You need a lot of time. There's another thing that came through from the survey is that the people that took part are spending at least half an hour most days thinking about horse racing.
A large number spending 2 hours plus as well.
Yeah,
it is a hobby that is almost endlessly deep in the sense that the more time you devote to it, the more you learn, the more you can deduce, and theoretically, the more successful you'll be if you're better.
And I mean, to that point, we asked them, you know, what is it that sort of attracts you to a race? What's your aim? What are you trying to get out of it? And the biggest number in the 70s, 70%, was I enjoy trying to solve the puzzle. I mean, and then that got a bigger number even than I like the thrill of winning.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, people enjoy the puzzle more than the thrill
of winning. It's an intellectual pursuit as well, and it speaks to racing, betting on racing being a skill pursuit rather than...
Oh, exactly that. Yeah, exactly. These are not the same people who are sort of spinning roulette wheels.
Which is what we have to remind ourselves next week when we're on day three at Cheltenham and haven't backed a winner?
We didn't spend enough time thinking about it. Like right now, we should all, whatever we're doing now, just stop, go away and study the form for the plate.
Exactly.
And the Ultima. So the point being, you know, older people, retired people have more time to engage. They have a bit more money to engage. If you're in your 20s and you're struggling to establish a career and you maybe got a young family, it's really difficult to find that. And so I think that's just a natural consequence that racing has an older audience as a result of that. It's not something to worry about. It's you know, something to cherish, really.
There was actually some interesting findings about younger followers of the sport as well, actually, which are worth pulling out, in that they were the group that responded most positively to declaring their interest in the sport was growing, but also, you know, they had a greater interest in anti-post betting than any other age group. They were also the most heavily in favour of jumps racing, although that is a common theme across all age cohorts. Quite interesting to see how their attitudes differ, and particularly in that anti-post thing, because people have been saying for as long as I've been in and around racing, anti-post betting is dying. But
they might have turned up just in time for the funeral. Do you think they're going to revive the game? That'd be nice.
I don't know.
I enjoy a bit of anti-post betting, but yeah, it's not like it used to be, those markets. They feel a bit empty.
Not quite. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Chris, thank you so much for your time and your insights. Scott, likewise to yourself. And thank you to everyone at home for following. You do not want to veer away from the Racing Post for all your Cheltenham coverage. We're going to be covering the build-up extensively this week on Racing Post digital platforms and, of course, in the newspaper. We're going to have a live blog running every single day, bringing you the latest news from our reporters around the country and at Cheltenham. And next week, we will, of course, be throwing the metaphorical kitchen sink at it, including with a full slate of shows on YouTube. From Monday to Friday, we will have Good Morning Cheltenham, which is on air, let me get this right, at 8:30 a.m. every single day, live from Cheltenham. And then from Monday to Thursday in the evening, In the Know, the In the Know panel will be digesting the action and looking ahead to the following day. And that will be live at 6 p.m. So please do join us wherever you get the Racing Post. And most of all, have a fantastic Cheltenham Festival. Thank you very much.